Okay, we're on chapter 2, number 3. I don't know what page it is. Sorry. But before we start, we need to go back. Elizabeth's not here because Amy's sick, and she and Ennis went over there to stay for 3 days because Donald's out of town. And actually, it was Sandra that asked the question, but she and Ennis, Elizabeth had a disagreement about it. And Steve actually covered this in class Wednesday night because I don't know if y'all remember or not. Last week, Sandra asked if it was this King Artaxerxes was the same one as in Ezra. And I looked at it, and I said, yeah. Well, after Sandra and Elizabeth went back and forth all day disagreeing on whether it was or not, and after Steve taught his class Wednesday night, it made a little more sense to me, because what he's saying is that section of verses is out of context. It's talking about the opposition all the way from the Zerubbabel's time through Nehemiah's, and then it goes back to, you know, where they are in Ezra, in the book of Ezra. So I did have a couple of questions about that, and I asked Steve, and he said that the research he did, he saw differing opinions here and there as to what that means. So does anybody have an idea that, or a suggestion that they want to? I didn't want to just leave it, especially since we discussed it in our auditorium class. Anybody have any comments on that? It does say Artaxerxes in Ezra, and Steve is very sure of his king order and his dates, you know, based on secular history, so which we have on the first page of our auditorium class, and that's what I was using too. So the only issues I had was how could they write that letter and get it to the king and get his response back and then get the temple completed in 52 days, unless the letter was sent before, you know, that 52-day period started, before they actually started work. And the other thing was, all those men that it listed as writing the letter are never mentioned in Nehemiah. So anyway, he was going to look onto that, and I don't know if there's an answer or not, to be honest, but that's the best explanation I have, because, you know, I agree with Steve. I think that's what he thinks is the best explanation, too, that it's just a parenthetical reference to all the years of opposition from the Gentiles in the area, the Samaritans or whoever. Okay? Okay. After Nehemiah's nocturnal journey in, we're still in chapter 2. He went in the middle of the night to go check out things, and he took a few men with him, chapter 2, verse 12. And what was, after he did that and saw the state of everything, what was his challenge to the Jews?
Well, he said, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies in waste, and the gates are burned with fire. He said, come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach.
Okay, I wrote that verse down to verse 17. Let us rise up and build. Let's get this done. Let's get on with this. There's work to be done here. It's important. And as long as we don't do it, we're a reproach to the nations around us, which reflects on whom?
God.
God, right. And he didn't like that. I mean, we talked about that before. It's a big issue with him.
And he reminded them what God had done. We talked about that before.
Okay. So what was their reaction to this challenge? Verse 18, let us rise up and build. Pretty amenable, weren't they? I thought it was remarkable throughout the book that the people, you know, Nehemiah said something, people just did it, because it's so different from what happened in Ezra. You know, they struggled around all the time, and somebody would say boo, and they'd quit. And here, and they have opposition here too, but they just keep right on working, you know, with Nehemiah's encouragement. So when they set, verse 18 says, let us rise up and build, and it says they set their hands to this good work. So what did they not say? Can y'all think of any excuses that people you've heard of use today when something needs to be done, there's work to be done? and what kind of things have you heard that we did not hear these people say?
I don't have time.
I don't have time.
I'm busy.
Because you're the only busy person in the world. Right? What?
Someone else can do it.
Somebody else can do it. Yeah, let George do it. What else?
Not good at that.
I'm not good at that. I've heard that a lot. I've heard that a lot. What about, we tried that once and it didn't work. So, why bother? How about we can't afford it? We don't have any material. We have no money. that kind of pops into my head as far as people, one of the most often heard excuses I've ever heard for not being hospitable is we can't afford it. Do you really have to spend a lot of money to have people over? No, you really don't. You don't have to take everybody out to eat. You can fix them a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and invite them over. Or a cup of coffee. You don't even have to feed them. Have them come over and play a game. You know, you don't have to do, you know, a full meal. Did we say it's too hard or it can't be done? That's kind of like I'm not good at that, but sometimes, I'm trying to think of an example. Somebody may not want to teach a specific topic, maybe, for example, back in the kids' classes, I don't know, because it's too hard or they don't understand it, or, you know, like maybe evolution. What if Rocky had said, I can't teach the high school kids evolution, it's just too hard for them, you know, that kind of thing. He didn't, but maybe somebody could. What about everything's fine like it is? Why would we want to rock the boat? You know, some people are just opposed to change, aren't they? Some people just get all complacent and, well, we're just going to have to rely on yours because I did this wrong, I think.
Okay. Good, because I wanted to speak up, but I didn't want it taped.
You didn't want it taped?
Because I was going to say, because whenever Pat asked me to teach ladies Bible class, I'm always like, but I think it's intimidating.
You're not alone. Why is it intimidating? I'm standing up here.
It's because y'all are like so knowledgeable, and you feel like you're going to say, I don't know, the wrong thing, or...
Do you know what?
You just...
I'm no more knowledgeable than you are. You know, you just start studying and you don't have to teach the entire Bible in one quarter.
Yeah.
You know, just pick a topic and...
One of my comments were going to be, it just, and sometimes I do this, even with a project I have, it just seems so messy. You don't know where to start. You just feel like, I can't, it's not that you don't want to do it, not that you think it's necessarily too hard. You know, it can be done. It's just you don't know where to begin. And that's the same thing with teaching. You don't, the first time I taught, you talk about having people more knowledgeable in your class. I had Sister Clark. I don't know if Sister Lane was here or not. She may have been.
I think she was.
And, I mean, I had women who knew a whole, and, you know, I don't know. It's not that I know a lot. You pick one thing, and you figure, okay, I may not know everything about this. And I guarantee you, people ask me questions I don't know. You just say, I don't know. We'll study on that together, and we'll see what we can figure out. And
that's the good thing. We have resources. You know, if we don't know, I talked to Steve about something yesterday because I want to make sure I had this clear in my head before I said it to y'all. And I know I've said things wrong. I know that I've said stuff that people have had to straighten me out on. And, you know, I didn't just start teaching yesterday. I mean, I started a long time ago. So if I seem knowledgeable, it's because I've been doing it a long time, I think. I don't think it's that I'm any more knowledgeable than you.
One thing I want you to think about, Gina. Do you know how Steve was when he started preaching? He started preaching full time when he was 19. And so do you not think there, the first congregation he preached at, there were people out there that knew way more than he did. And when he came here and started teaching ladies Bible class, Sister Lane knew a whole lot more than he did. And she was very good. She would call him. She never embarrassed him in class. She would call him on the phone and she'd say, Steve, have you thought about this?
And he was in it. Were he in his 30s when y'all moved here?
Yeah.
Late 30s, mid to late.
And, but she was, you know, and so nobody, you know, if somebody comes to you and gets ugly because they feel like you've taught something wrong, it's their problem, not yours.
If I teach something wrong, I need to know. I want to know. I want somebody to come talk to me. And, you know, I'm really not teaching. I'm just kind of leading this thing. You hear all the comments? I think that's one reason I really... especially like a ladies class, because when somebody like Steve's teaching, who has been studying and teaching as long as he has, I don't like to even speak up much. I mean, I think I'm better about that than I used to be.
But he doesn't feel that way.
No, he doesn't. I know, but there's not much to say because he already knows everything. He says it all. But I mean, he's covered the thing. But you know, I need help having a class. I mean, I could never just get up here and, well, I guess I could. It'd be awful boring if I just did all the talking and y'all the same thing. But believe me, you're not alone. Other people have said the same thing. And it is a little bit intimidating, I guess, first time or two.
But oh, listen.
It's very intimidating.
You still think it's intimidating?
No, I'm
when you begin.
First time or
okay.
Two.
Well, and it depends, too, on your subject. When I taught Ephesians here a few years ago, I struggled through that whole thing. I couldn't wait for it to be over. I just felt like it was not that good a class. I felt like it did accomplish much. I don't know how.
I felt that way when I taught First John. I didn't handle that well at all.
I don't know how the class felt about it, but I mean, I got comments and feedback that people enjoyed the class, appreciated it, but I thought, when is this going to be over?
I think sometimes one of the hardest things is coming up with something to teach. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm supposed to teach next week, and I have a one-shot class now. I've been, ever since we talked about it, and I told her I'd teach, I've been talking to Lauren about what I'm going to do. How do you, and so I finally came out
this
time and
don't even
get
cut off. Okay. But anyway, if we just are careful that, you know, if we follow the example of the Israelites, the remnant that returned, you know, that they're willing to do what needs to be done. And we're going to see in chapter 3, everybody doesn't do the same thing. Everybody doesn't have the same talent. And we're going to talk about this in regard to how we live today and how we function as a church, as a group, as a congregation. You know, everybody doesn't do everything. And so you teach out there, don't you? You do teach. Okay, so the point here is, I guess, don't just sit back and expect somebody else to do everything, you know, or say, I can't do it, or I don't know how to do it, or we tried that and it didn't work. We've got to be willing to work, I guess. That's the bottom line there, like the Israelites were.
Well, what we're doing has to be important.
All through this book, it calls this a great work, a great work, a great work. This isn't just nothing. This is getting that city back into shape to where they're no longer a reproach. And obviously, teaching a Bible class is important. Is that what you're going to say?
Well, in the Lord's work, we need to see the importance of it.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't always take a back seat. So many times, it's easy to put off reading or studying to be prepared to teach because you just don't. You don't see the importance of it. It's not important to us. I think sometimes what we spend our time on shows what we feel like is important to us. Just like even with our worship, do we let things get in the way? What's more important? You know, do I plan my week? So these things, priority is God's worship and encouraging his people and being here. We see people who that's not their priority. We know that because they're not even here every Sunday. And it's not like they're going somewhere else.
And what are we teaching our kids there when we're not here on a regular basis or don't come to class or whatever? You know, what the kids grow up thinking, it's not important to be there. It's not that big of a deal. It's not we didn't go when I was a kid. Why should I go now?
We teach more about what we do than what we say.
Yes. Well, I thought I was turning this off, but I don't. I can't figure out how to turn off the red light.
That's okay.
All right, let's go to number 4. Describe the enemy and their first attempt to discourage the workers. I'm playing it. I'm hearing myself. I recorded something. I'm talking. How do you turn this off, Sandra?
I guess on the side. I think that turns the machine on and off.
Yes, that puts it on hold. How do I turn this off? Gene, I didn't even know I was recording. I've got to find.
You got me.
Gene!
I think I was recording too. My phone. So we got you.
I can't. Nothing I'm doing turns it off and it's talking.
I don't know anything about it, Lauren. I'm sorry.
I don't know why I picked the battery. I'm very sorry.
But I can't have that talking during class.
I don't know if this is right, but what was it about the mocking and despising and rebelling against the king?
Yes, that's where we're starting. But who are the people that are doing that first? Who are they? They got names. A couple of them do. Three of them. Sanballat and Tobias seem to be the ringleaders. Sanballat the Horonite, some kind of official, and Tobiah, I believe, the Ammonite is his servant, if I understand it right. The Ammonites are the avowed. Is it still going? Take the battery out. Okay. I've never seen that happen. The Ammonites are the avowed enemies of the Jews. Where do the Ammonites come from? Anybody remember? Thank you. Y'all know this. Where?
I forgot who it was.
Well, they came from the same place the Moabites came from.
Esau.
No, they're Lot's kids.
Yeah.
Lot's daughters that slept with him each had a son, and that was the beginning of the Ammonites and the Moabites. Okay, and they're
Lot.
Oh, have I got that wrong?
Yeah.
Moabites and the Ammonites, don't they come from Lot's
children? Yeah, I didn't do that. I'm sorry, I didn't distract
you. You scared me to death. Okay, yes. And so they are the avowed enemy of Israel, and we know Tobiah is an Ammonite. We also know in chapter 6 that they're related to some of the Jewish workers by marriage. We're going to talk more about that later, because there's all kinds of intermarriage here, which what was done back in Ezra's day, we haven't quite gotten to it in the auditorium class, but what was done about the intermarriage going on then? They had to give up their wives and kids. They sent them away. But evidently it's going on again. And in chapter 13, we find that Tobiah is allied with Eliashib, the high priest. So they're just mixed in here, you know, kind of gotten their fingers in everything, and they don't belong in here. They don't belong in Jerusalem. They don't belong working with the Jews. They need to be out of the way. Okay, for some reason, they are deeply disturbed by Nehemiah coming to seek the well-being of Israel. They don't want the walls built. I don't know what their problem is. I don't know why it's their business. And I commented in the Wednesday night class, I think, that Nehemiah tells them at some point, this is none of their business. It has nothing to do with them. They can't help. But as Gina said, the first thing they did was started out with ridicule, laughing at them and despising them, derision and contempt, and then accusing them of rebellion against the king. Now, this worked once before, right? In Ezra chapter 4, which we've talked about in the auditorium class. So I don't know if it's the same people. It's not that long ago, but it's some similar people at least. And then obviously Nehemiah's reaction is, this is God's work, these are God's people, and you don't have any business, you have no part in the matter. So we're going to find over the next few chapters that they have all kinds of tricks in their arsenal to try to stop this work, all the way up to, you know, contacting the king and slandering the Israelites. But what they're doing here is they thought if they went and talked to Nehemiah and told him how stupid he was, that he would quit. And obviously, Nehemiah does what in verse 4? In reaction to their first approach. He prayed. Hear us, because we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads. They're obviously not good people. They're not. They don't have a good motive. Their goals aren't in line with God's. So, you know, we talked in the first chapter about his patience in waiting on a good time to approach the king, and in planning, coming up with a plan. So this chapter just embodies his faith. He believes that God is going to deliver them from these naysayers. He believes that God's going to help them make sure that the wall gets built. I mean, he started from chapter 1 praying to God and asking God specifically for what was needed, and, you know, for strength and courage and for permission from the king and all that. Also, I wanted to talk a little bit about his determination and perseverance. Notice chapter 2, verse 4, Hear, O God. Oops, that's the wrong verse. Hang on a minute. 6, verse 6. Chapter 2, verse 6. He prayed to God, do not cover their iniquity, do not let their sin be blotted out from before you. And chapter 6 says, so we built the wall. Look at verse 11. Our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. And then it says, so it was in verse 12. I've got the wrong verse there too. When the Jews who dwelt near them came, that they told us 10 times. My point is, note how many times it says so. Chapter 2. No wonder I can't find it. I'm in chapter 4. I'm sorry. I'm ahead of myself, because they're in those verses too. Okay, I'm sorry. Go back to chapter 2.
That's okay.
All right. So the king said to me, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Then verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Verse 18. So they said, let us rise up and build. And then go over to chapter 4, verse 6. So we built the wall in verse 20. Let's see, what was that other one? 21. So we labored in the work. And then in verse 6:15, so the wall was finished on the 25th day. So what does so mean anyway? S-O. How would you define that? Well, I put down that it means with the result that, or therefore. You know how often Steve talks about the word therefore and the word for being connecting words, and referring back to what was said in the verse or the passage before, and having to do with that, so that the connection is with what comes after the so is connected to what comes before the so. Okay, kind of like therefore and for. So it's a sense of moving, and no sitting around, no wasting time. Just so this happened. Okay, and that's why I pointed to his determination and his perseverance, because it kept moving to the next step. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 15:58. Gina, will you read that, please?
1 Corinthians 15:58. Mm-hmm. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord.
Okay, so Paul was telling the Corinthians the same thing that was going on in Nehemiah. You know, you have to keep moving forward. Your work is not in vain. Be steadfast. Steadfast means ongoing, keep going, not steady, not dropping off or going back two steps with every forward step. And I think that's what Nehemiah is encouraging the Jews to do in the book of Nehemiah as far as getting this wall built. And he keeps going back to God in prayer. He keeps going back to God in reference when he's encouraging the people to ignore the enemy, ignore the people that are trying to discourage them. Okay, does anybody else have any other comments on this one before we go to the next chapter? Okay, I put down that chapter 3 is about work. And we've talked about this a little bit, well, quite a bit, actually. Why is Nehemiah so concerned about the reproach of the Jews?
I feel like because he thinks it's a reflection on God.
I agree. I think his sole concern is for the glory of God. He wants what he's doing to be to glorify God, and he's trying to encourage the Jews to see this as the same way. The mockery of the and ridicule of the Gentiles or the Samaritans illustrates the reproach. And I mean, it's very clear to anybody who's listening or looking that, you know, they are what's the word? Not ludicrous, but they're a laughingstock. They're a laughingstock because, you know, they've been carried off into captivity, and here they are feebly trying to put their city back together and not having any results. Okay, now in chapter 3, we're going to talk about the different kinds of work. Yes?
One other thing on the reproach. What this brought to my mind was Moses, when twice God was going to make up him a nation, and he was so just fed up with the Jews on the Exodus. But Moses, both times, he did, you know, instead of his pride getting in the way and saying, fine, let's do it, I'm part of it too, it was always, this will look bad on you. The people will say, you were not able. The nations round about will say you were not able to bring this people out. And so I think that's a lesson we can learn from that and from Nehemiah and his concern is we need to be careful that we are concerned about how God is viewed and that our lives don't bring reproach upon God. We think our lives bring reproach upon us, but if we claim to be God's people and we don't live according to God's plan, well, her God really does her a lot of good. Is what people say. And I don't want to have a God like that.
Well, not only that, people who lived a life and claimed to be God's people and then left, that, you know, they're doing a lot of damage too to the people around in the world. Said, man, that for a godly man or a godly woman, they didn't act a whole lot of good their God did then.
But if we're not careful, we can be that ungodly person if we don't put God in the proper place.
Right.
That's what happens, is when God is not the primary focus of our lives, we become a reproach also.
Okay. And is that always evident to the people in the building sitting on the pews? Sometimes people are living in a way that would probably horrify us if we knew what was going on in their lives. And, I mean, we don't know, but who does? God does know. And God's going to reward and punish appropriately because that's what he's promised he's going to do. We have a whole Bible with a history of him doing that with his people. If you live this way, this is what you get. If we don't, this is what you get. And what is our promise if we live this way? What are we going to have? We get to go to heaven. And fortunately, God's mercy is involved, and is patience and long-suffering, because we're all humans and imperfect and mess up a lot, don't we? Okay, now, just really there's not a specifically, what I mean is there's not a whole lot of different jobs here. Everybody's fixing this or fixing that. They're all working on repairing, but they're in different spots. They're in different stations around the walls. Maybe there's some professional people, but there are 38 individuals named by name in 42 different groups, and they're all working in different sections with different jobs. So I don't know if there's a coordinating foreman or what. I don't know how hard it would be to build a wall. I'm assuming they're just stacking up bricks or blocks or rocks or something. And they probably had to have specialists for the iron work. You know, I guess they had the hinges and things like that. But they did have professional craftsmen. So the go back here to this, my question. Oh, no. Hang on a minute. I'll get myself turned around. Okay, in addition to the different jobs, which is really the same job, but, you know, it takes different kinds of people, what do you think the women are doing? It doesn't say any specific women in this chapter. Pat?
One man said his daughters.
That's true, you're right. There were some daughters doing something. Okay, but they were helping. Okay, but what do you think all the other women are doing? You think they're just sitting at home eating bonbons? Don't you imagine they're being supported because the people said, let us rise up and build. They're either feeding people, yes. Maybe they're carrying supplies here and there. Maybe they're stacking rocks, you know, who knows. I totally believe that they are doing their part, even though they're not listed. But the point is, the different individuals and the different jobs to be done, it takes all kinds of people. We have rulers and priests, they are mentioned, men and women that are mentioned, professional craftsmen, even some from outside the city. Now, they're Jews, they're not Gentiles, but they just happen to live in other cities. Like, you know, the ones from Jericho, the ones from that town that started with T. It's not coming to you right this second, but we'll get to it in a minute. Tekoa. So also we have, look at verse 1. Eliashib the high priest rose up with his brethren the priests and built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They built as far as the Tower of the Hundred and consecrated it, then as far as the Tower of Hananel. So what do we have here? The example of whom? The priests. The high priest and the other priests. In other words, the leaders aren't sitting around saying, you do this, you do that. They're not delegating. They are working too. So they lead by example. They show everybody that, you know, we're not too good to do this. We're going to work too. Look at verse 5. Next to them, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. So what do you have in this verse? Some people who chose to what?
Nobles.
Some of the nobles chose not to work. Do we see that today? In a congregation, say, you know, we've heard many times Steve say that this is a team, you know, we need to work together. But even so, not just here, but everywhere, there are always somebody that's not going to do anything. And we can either let that discourage us, or we can try to encourage them and try to get them to make a change there. But I think I accepted a long time ago. I think that was real hard for me when I was young to understand that. I didn't understand why some people just sat and did nothing. But it doesn't change. I think they had them back then. I think we've always had them, and I think we still do. Now, let's look at verse 27. Verse 5. You have the Tekoites making repairs, and then in verse 27, the Tekoites repaired another section. And then in verse 4, you've got Meremoth, the son of Urijah, making repairs. And in verse 21, Meremoth, the son of Urijah, repaired another section. So you have some doing what?
Multiple.
They're doing more than others. You know, they'll finish one job and move to the next. That may have been happening more than it's listed. But the point is, we have some who don't do much. We have some who do a lot. We have some who do nothing. We have some who do just what they need to not get withdrawn from or not get kicked out of the Jewish nation. So how does this compare with the work of the church today? I've been alluding to it a lot. That what do y'all have in your notes?
There's all kinds of jobs that need to be done, and you can find something to do. If you want to work, of the parables that Jesus taught was that, you know, we all have abilities and we have to use them.
Right.
It's like the parable of the talent. I may not have as much talent as you do, but I better be sure I'm using every ounce that I have to the best of my ability, because that's what I'm going to be judged from. We're judged by what we're able to do.
Right.
Not what we don't think we can do, but
right.
what we really can do.
Okay, there are things we can't do. We can't lead singing. We can't teach the auditorium class. I doubt there's very many men here that are going to go out there and teach two-year-olds. I've heard of it happening, but it's probably not going to happen much. There are... Toy Robinson is not going to teach a class. She used to. She taught for years and years and years, but is she able now? She simply is not able. People with brand-new babies, can they go teach a class? No. There's so much that can be done. What about taking food to people? People who are sick, people who have had surgery, people who have somebody die. Or maybe take somebody to the doctor. Some of our husbands might not can do that because they're at work, but we can do that. Yes?
We can take the attendance list and we can,
absolutely.
Go through it and we can either make a call or we can send a card.
Mm-hmm. Send an email.
And, you know, yes. And sometimes, though, I think we're not lazy, but it is work to send an email or a card. But we hate to make that phone call because we may get a question or we may run into something we don't know what we're going to face. But it's good for us to make a contact. Maybe even call up and say, can I just drop some cookies by and see what I can do to help you? I know they got something contagious. But sometimes people are just discouraged and you get them in their home or you get in their home. Either way, you can say, would you come by and just have a cup of coffee? Sometimes if they do have a spiritual problem, they will open up and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more than they're just going to, well, I visit with them at church, but that may not be where they're going to feel comfortable opening up and talking about the problem.
What about the ones who are the same thing? Oh, we're not same old, same old, same old, same old. They're never here. Or same problem, same marriage problem, or same kid problem, or whatever. Is it okay to just drop them off the list? They're the ones that I find hardest to call. Because, you know, you run out. What else can I possibly say to these people? But, you know, you don't want to give up on them because God's not going to give up on us. And so if we remember that we need to keep. And I think picking up the list is a great idea.
Steve, that's where he emails it most of the time.
Yeah, he does. And I like that. Because half the time I don't think to pick it up. And I really like getting an email. So, and you know, in 1 Corinthians 12, let's look at that real quick. And what is that chapter about?
Well, it compares the functioning of the church
right.
to the functioning of the body.
Right, and it's about spiritual gifts.
Yes.
Okay, but when it comes down to the description of the body, is how does it compare the members of the church?
Well, you can't function properly if you have one thing or, you know,
just a head.
The arm is not going to do the job of a son or,
right.
you know, it just, you can't really function without, I mean, you can function physically, I guess, but when it comes to...
It works better if everybody's functioning.
Exactly.
Right.
And you can't do it unless everybody's working together and doing their part.
Right. And even back in the section where it's talking about spiritual gifts, there's... Verse 4 through 11 talks about there's diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are differences of ministries, but the same Lord. There are diversities of activities, but the same God who works in all. They're all for the common good. They're all from the Lord. They're all through the same Spirit. And then it goes into the discussion of the body, like Anna's talking about, where, you know, not everybody is a head, not everybody's an arm, but we can't function without all of it. To function properly, like Anna said, we can function, but not as well, not in a complete manner. And I don't know that we need to sit back and say, well, I'm just a finger. There's not a whole lot I can do. We need to, and I don't think we need to even define what we are. We need to think of ourselves as part of the body, a functioning part that's necessary to the whole, because it's all for the common good. That's why we're here. You know, can't we all worship God at home? Can't we pray at home? Can't we sing at home? Teach our kids at home? So why do we come here?
To encourage one another.
To encourage and build up one another. We need one another. That helps us stay strong. It helps us get through the rest of the week. You know, it reminds us of why we're here on earth. I mean, this is our spiritual family. We do need one another.
I think if Linda was here, she could, you know, speak to the fact that you get a little thorn in your hand, and you lose just a little bit of bone in one hand, and have two fingers that don't work right. There's so many things that you can still do, but they don't work smoothly, and you're not doing them as well, because she has trouble gripping things. Mm-hmm. She has trouble holding things with her fingers. Just little simple things, like cutting Holly's hair. You know, she has to work to... You know, you use your left. You should
right, you hold
you
the hair.
Hold, and you're washing dishes. It's hard to wash dishes with one hand. You got to have two. And there for a while, she couldn't hold anything with that hand.
Wow.
And so, you think one little tiny part of the body, that's not that big of a deal, but it is. And it's the same thing in the Lord's body. When you have one that's a thorn, rather, you know, you got a thorn in you and you're not behaving right, it affects everybody. It affects your whole being.
Right, and you may not realize it, or, you know, if we think, well, it's not going to be a big deal if I don't show up tonight. But how we need to think about how we're affected when somebody's not here, and they're not here, and they're not here. How discouraging is that? That, you know, that we're not important enough for them to come here and to encourage me, or us.
Another way to look at that, too, Lord, is when we travel. Sometimes when we travel, we think, you know, it's not that big a deal. But we have been places, small little places, and they're so encouraged. If you're there, whether it's Sunday morning or Wednesday night or whatever, they just feel that, you know, we're not alone in this. There are people who put God first. And I'm not saying it's a sin to miss a service if you're traveling. That's not my point at all. But my point is, how much good do we do when we do arrange our trip to where we can be with brethren to encourage them? Sometimes it's impossible.
I feel that way here when we have visitors who are church or here or attending here because they've got to catch a plane. You know, they're making a point of being somewhere. You know, they give it some
time.
Yes, like Billy. You know, he could have spent 6 months put loose and fancy free.
Well, and here a few weeks ago, we had a man who was just here for 1 week tonight, and he even sent back a note at how much he appreciated how warmly he was welcomed. And so.
You never know the impact you have on people. Yeah. And if you're not here, you're not going to get to meet these people. But on the other hand, can anybody do everything? Can we sit back and expect somebody to handle the whole thing, whether it's the elders, the preacher, the older women? You know, sometimes, or the younger women. Sometimes it's think, you know, they're younger, they can handle that better than I can. Or I've done my share, I'm not doing that anymore. We all need to stay focused and stay involved and say, one thing I really like about this class is that we have a cross-section of ages. In fact, I've always thought my kids grew up around a cross-section of ages. We didn't just hang out with people their age. You know, we hung out with couples of older kids and people with younger kids and older people whose kids were grown. And I think your kids learn to react and interact with people of all ages when you do that. Especially Christians. Think of the influence older Christians can have on your kids and how encouraging it is to older Christians for people like Laura and Anna and, you know, and Amanda to be here and have young kids here with them. Bring your kids, and they're teaching their kids, and it's obvious by the way they behave and that kind of thing. It is to me hugely encouraging, hugely. Okay, anything else on that one?
I just wanted to say sometimes it's easier for us women to, well, you know, I can't go up there and, you know, lead a hymn, or I can't do this, and sometimes we use that as an excuse. Well, I'm a female, I can't do that. I've heard, you know, unfortunately, sisters in Christ, well, you know, I really can't do a lot. And so that's why sometimes the church doesn't grow. Because, you know, we can get out and we can pass out leaflets, or we can, you know, there's a lot of stuff.
We can talk to our neighbors.
Talk to your neighbors. Mm-hmm. Some talk to our family members that are not members of the church. You know, so it's just a lot of times they find to use that as an excuse. Oh, male, a female, I can't do that. But, I mean, there are so many things that we can do as women. It's, I mean, just encouraging our children, you know.
Yes. And you know what? Even if it's just organizing a play date for our children and spending some time with one another, that can be very encouraging because then you can talk about things that you're struggling with, either with your kids or with your faith or with, you know, your Bible study or whatever. And, you know, I always was able to get ideas from other women. What can I do? I remember there was a young woman here several years ago that used to take her two very small children and make cookies and go visit the elderly. I remember taking my girls to visit elderly people, but I don't remember taking cookies. And I feel real bad I didn't think of that. But anyway, I just was, that's very encouraging to me. And, you know, it's impressive to me when people care about lonely old people who would just love to see small children. Yeah. Just, they just love it. They eat it up. So, well, you know what? I thought I had studied enough for when I get back from my I do want to say one more thing. Anyway, that's all I got. So now I got to study some more for it, because I get back from my trip on Tuesday night, and I want to be ready for that class. I just look back up here. I wanted to comment on the fact that in chapter 3, built is the word built appears 6 times, repair appears 35 times, and bolts and bars appears 5 times. So it is definitely about the actual nuts and bolts of building, the physical work. And another point is they work together, though apart, they have the same leadership. We work together as a congregation here. We have the same leadership. We have the same elders, although we do individual things. We don't all follow some code that we do the exact same thing on Monday and the exact same thing on Tuesday. You know, we know what we need to do, and we just work within our schedules. But if we think about the church as a whole, the Christians worldwide that are all trying to serve the Lord, That's a very encouraging thing to me, even because everybody is trying to live a godly life and trying with the goal of going to heaven and with the goal of encouraging other people to have the same goal and to be saved and to know Jesus. So although I guess because the wall, it's a big city and there's a wall all the way around it, and they're not all standing in the same room, working on the same room or on the same building. Like, to me, this is totally different from building the temple. Because when they're in the temple, they're within speaking distance for the most part. Here they are not. So I think it's remarkable that Nehemiah was able to motivate them to, you know, in such a widespread way, in a big, over a big area, to do such a big job.
You know, yeah. When we talk about things we can't do, and we did this one year, I think when the first had suggested it, we could get to know the people that the preachers wives that were supporting. One year, each lady took a turn, and they got a card and
corresponded.
They wrote a note, and then we all signed it and sent it. And I think about that. I don't know why we don't do it more than that. But I mean, it's just something. But we don't always think about the things we can do. We dwell on the things we can't do.
Well, something else that's impressive to me is I don't know who's always doing this, but somebody has recently been teaching the little bitty kids, and they'll make a card for somebody who's really, really sick, and have all of them sign it. You know, this is the ones I think that can write. I don't think it's the ones that still scribble their name. But, and then they started just giving them to different people. I got one time. I was so excited. I was so touched. Are you one that did that?
I did it, but I got it from Nisha.
What a wonderful idea. Just to talk to the kids about a certain person. And then, when you did that, did you have a picture of the person? Because a lot of the little kids aren't going to know who everybody is.
No, not always.
But one of the kids would bring it to me. It was so sweet. I love that.
I'd ask them if they knew him. And they
you'd find one
that
knew
him. Yes or no, and then if they didn't, I'd say, well, take it to your mom or dad, and y'all can walk together to do it.
Okay, well, I just thought that was a great idea. Real, real sweet and
There's a group in Baytown at Eastside. They did it for a long time. I don't know if they're still doing it or not. But they would send, they would get the older girls, I say the older girls, probably, they could write. Some of them could barely write, you know, you could tell. And they would each write a little note. And then whoever was doing it, they would put it all in an envelope and mail it. I got one when my back was so bad, and they had Celeste had asked for prayers for me, and I got one. And it was just a little packet, and some of them were real cute, and some of them would just say, I'm sorry you're hurting, or I don't know you, but I hope you get better. whatever they came up with. And then they would have glitter and little stickers and different things, and they spend a Sunday afternoon once a month. They did that.
Well, you know, that's teaching kids to think outside of themselves. Mm-hmm. And little kids, you know, that's a process anyway. Growing up, you know, you go from a baby that needs food and clean pants and to getting away from my needs into somebody else's needs. You know, what can I do for you instead of what can you do for me? So, anything else?
Let me run back here and get the class first.
Pat, you don't have them? They're back there running off? Okay, Pat, I am going to be gone next week. Pat's going to teach, and she has a lesson.